the studios of KPCW in Park City. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Pete Stoughton.
This morning we speak first with author Amy Herman, who has trained thousands of people around the world on an innovative and unique approach to problem solving. It involves using works of art to revitalize our minds and refine our creative thinking.
And then, are you ready to take action on the deeper dreams you've been putting on hold? Local author Ellie Vajari joins the show to discuss her new book, The 90-Day Life, How to Live More in 3 Months Than You Have in 3 Years.
These two guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Join us Thursday for Cool Science Radio. We speak first with addiction physician and bioethicist, Dr. Carl Eric Fisher, all about the science of addiction. He joins to discuss his new book, The Urge, Our History of Addiction.
And then Chad Orzel, who has written A Brief History of Timekeeping, The Science of Marking Time from Stonehenge to Atomic Clocks.
That's Thursday at 9 a.m. following the local news hour and NPR News. Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Pete Stoughton.
Our first guest this morning is the founder and president of The Art of Perception, Inc. And she's trained thousands of professionals from Navy SEALs to trauma nurses for whom things can go wrong much of the time. Well, like they do for all of us. Amy Herman has written a new book called Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. She joins us to share her successful methodology that refreshes and rejuvenates essential critical thinking skills and to help people resolve problems and hone their powers of perception. Amy Herman, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me. Thrilled to be here. I wish I were in the mountains right now.
It is a beautiful bluebird day here. White snow, blue sky, great skiing. We love the place we live.
I bet. It sounds gorgeous. New York does not look like that this morning.
I can only imagine. Well, let's see. I'm in the Louvre Museum in Paris. I'm sitting in front of the Mona Lisa. I'm staring and I'm waiting for some deeper meaning to come to me, one that's going to help me figure out how to creatively solve problems. Where do I go from there?
Well, I think my first suggestion would be to step away from the Mona Lisa because there are too many people around it. That's my first piece of advice. I tell people that when we go into a museum, I ask them to think about what works of art speak to them, not what they think they should look at. So I suggest going into a gallery and thinking to yourself, well, which of these would I like to take home with me? Don't do it, but just think about it. And then moving closer to that work of art and start thinking about all its different elements. Why are you drawn to it? Is it the color? And don't read the label. Is it the color? Is it the subject? Is it the frame? Is it close to a place to sit down? Are you comfortable? And then really start looking at it and thinking about all the different elements. And I find that there are so many distractions in our world. I mean, our whole day is filled with distractions, that looking at a work of art engages our brain in a way that nothing else does. We use certain neurons, and it's a way of focusing our thinking that can be directly applied to problem solving.
Can you go a little deeper into that, what it does in our brains when we're observing and really being still and observing art?
Absolutely. One of the things, and what I'm holding up now is my phone. I'm holding it up to the screen. This is the biggest distraction for all of us. You know, we're looking for instant messaging and instant gratification and how many likes and who's texting us. And the beautiful thing about looking at a work of art is you don't need that. And it just brings you back to your own brain. And I'm going to take a quote from a colleague of mine who said, and it's just, I think about this all the time. He said, neurons that fire together wire together. And when you're looking at a work of art, your neurons are firing in a way that they don't in any other experience. It's like when you listen to a piece of music or you watch a film or dance or a work of art, your brain works in a way that it doesn't in any other time. And my hope is that when you look at that work of art, you'll think about everything that went into it, not just what the artist did and what the subject is, but how it was created and how it looks there. So that's why when I tell people to go to an art museum, don't spend more than an hour. Spend quality time with a work of art, engage with it, think about it, and last but not least, read the label. And then when you're out back in the world with all our distractions and all our problems, think back to that process. How did the artist create that work? How break it into bite-sized pieces? How do we get from point A to B to C instead of point A to Z? It's thinking about the creative process. It's thinking about the preparation and thinking about our engagement with it. I know it sounds crazy, and I know it sounds sort of touchy-feely, but the art, we've been looking at art for centuries. And I think to be able to channel that power of creativity into concrete problem solving is really a cool idea.
Well, and you have a history with visual art and visual intelligence in your other books and your previous career. But a lot of our listeners are probably more auditory, you know, as they're listening to us on radio. So they might have this disposition towards auditory learning. How is this visual intelligence so critical in this concept of problem solving? And what does one who perhaps is listening right now, who's auditory focused, learn this visual skill?
It's a great question. And the best analogy I can give you is something that I've started doing myself. I'm a very visual person, but I've started listening to books. I've started listening to books when I don't drive much because I live in New York City, but when I am alone or walking or just before I go to sleep. And the beautiful thing about listening, auditory skills and visual skills are not mutually exclusive. When I listen to a book or I listen to the radio, I visualize who's speaking. I think about character development in a different way. And I think our brains automatically envision something, so that auditory learning and visual learning are really not that far apart. And I tell people that to prepare for this career that I had, I'm a recovering attorney and I'm also an art historian. And I like to think that I combine the practical aspects of each of those disciplines, legal analysis and visual analysis, and I combine them to think about looking. And that works with auditory skills. You think about what you're listening. It doesn't go in one ear and out the other. It passes through the brain and you envision in different ways. It's like people that are visually impaired can look at art and discuss it. And so I think the skills are more complementary than they are exclusive. And I love describing works of art, and I love listening to other people describe works of art, because what I hear doesn't always match what I see, and it broadens my own visualization, if that makes sense.
Yes. And you actually, in some other areas, have discussed how important this skill set is in professional settings. And the used an example of The Last Supper. How can this skill set of visual intelligence, which then goes into the problem solving component, be so critical in the workplace, even for like police officers and FBI that you've worked with?
Well, one of the things that is applicable across the professional spectrum is to break down our big problems into digestible pieces. You know, we are facing just myriad problems right now. Where do we begin to talk about what's wrong in the world, right? We could talk about it all day, but it becomes overwhelming so quickly. And one of the things that I love to do about art, and you referenced The Last Supper, and in the book that I just wrote, I use The Raft of the Medusa. I take these huge works of art and I ask viewers and listeners and readers to break them into small digestible pieces. What's in the upper left-hand corner? What's in the upper right-hand corner? What's in the foreground? What's in the background? And when we start to break it apart and we sort of celebrate the milestones, okay, I've figured out what's going on over here, let me move over here, things are not, it's not such a behemoth anymore. It's not such an albatross around your neck. And the example I give you is in a crime scene. One of the things police officers have told me that they do after taking my training is they go to the crime scene, they're in a hurry, they have to get there, they walk in, they see the crime scene, and then they walk out and walk in again to see what they might have missed on the way in. How many steps did they go up? Were there any shell casings? Was there any blood? Where could there be fingerprints? And so by breaking things into small pieces, I use art as the data to show people how to do that. Because we want to take it all in all at once. We're just bombarded with so much information. And I say, you know what? That's fine. Let's stop. We'll get to all the information, But let's take it in pieces. The Last Supper, how many people are at the table? What is each person doing? Who is the central figure? And somehow things are more approachable when you can break them into small pieces.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Amy Herman. She's an art historian and an attorney. She's written a new book about problem solving. It's called Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. And it's all about fine art. So in looking through your book, Amy, you know, let's take step number two, for example, change your shoes. You have a painting of a view of Budapest City from the Fisherman Bastion. And it looks sort of like a photo, but I'm assuming it's a painting. Is that right?
Yes, I'm turning to the page now so I can look at it with you.
And
yes, go ahead.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, drawing from what you said in the last response, which is taking things, you know, in bite-sized pieces. So looking at the sky and the clouds in it, looking at the pillars or the columns from where the viewer is looking out to the river and to these beautiful buildings in Budapest. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you know, why this painting, and what can I take from it that relates to this step number two of change your shoes?
It's a great question, and this image and the one on the next page are two of my favorites in the book. This view of Budapest, one of the reasons I'm drawn to it is because your eye stretches as far as it can see off to the horizon. You also see architectural buildings. You see a river bisecting the picture. Then you see buildings on the other side of the river. But the whole thing is framed by the architecture that you're looking at. And so, you know, when we look at a view there, when I talk about changing your shoes, I'm talking about stepping in. It's actually a pun. You're stepping into other people's shoes to realize that no two people see anything the same way. An architect is going to look at this picture different than a city planner is going to look at it. It's going to be different than a meteorologist. But the reason this is called Change Your Shoes is if you turn the page in the book, there's an extraordinary memorial that's on the banks of the Danube in Budapest, and it is a series of iron shoes. And when you first look at it, you think, well, why are all these shoes next to the river? And it is a memorial to the Jews that were brought to the banks of the river in World War II, told to take their shoes off, and they were shot and killed. And so they were brought there by the Arrow Cross militia, and this memorial, it's so human because it's shoes. All of us wear shoes, and it's a reminder of all the people that were killed. And in the photograph of the memorial, you can see some of the same beautiful architecture in the background that you can see on the page before. So what I ask my viewers and readers to do is, you don't have to stand in someone else's shoes, but you have to meet them where they are. You have to validate where they're coming from. And I think in our really divisive world right now, it's necessary. We don't have to agree with everyone, but we have to understand that they're coming from a different place than we are. And I call that changing your shoes.
Mm, that's really nice. This I haven't seen this along the Danube before, the shoes.
It's very powerful.
It's a very, very powerful
memorial.
It's very powerful. And you know, when you look at it, as I'm looking at it in this photograph, that you just know what it is and why it's there and who it's a memorial to. You just get that sense. So mm-hmm. as you're talking, it's making me think that this is building empathy in us as we're able to see how someone else perceives the world, whether it's through art or a particular vista, as I'm looking out at the mountains and the buildings in our beautiful little town. It helps, I don't know, like reimagine how someone else views everything, and therefore mm-hmm. creating some empathy, or I don't know. And I can see, I'm starting to see how that translates into problem solving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a great example. And as you were talking, it reminded me, I was in Colorado a few years ago, and I was training the fire wardens and the firefighters in in the forests, in the mountains. And here I am, you know, a woman in New York City. I live in a building with, you know, 1,000 people. What do I know about training mountain firefighters? And as I took my ride up the mountains, I had to get to their station because that's where I was going to do the training. As I took that route up the mountains, I thought, well, I'm not a firefighter. I don't live in Colorado, but let me step into their shoes and look at the terrain on my hour-long ride up to their fire station to see what they see every single day. And I was looking at the landscape with totally fresh eyes. I'm not a firefighter. And I was thinking about the problems they encounter and how they describe where they are, because they all know the terrain, but I don't. And so we talked about communication, and where our worlds intersected is when they told me that visitors to the mountains and hikers often have to describe where someone got lost, and they lose that visual. You know, just because you're a hiker doesn't mean that you can communicate exactly where you are and where you left someone. And so they have to use those visual intelligence skills every single day in a way that I don't use them, and some of my colleagues, but everybody's visual intelligence and that idea of empathy, I call it perceptual empathy, stepping into other people's shoes to think about how they see the world. And that was a real eye opener for me in Colorado.
Well, your experience in Colorado actually brought up something I was thinking about in your previous question. Is it better to be an expert, a professional in that field, or to be the new observer? I mean, where does that relate into that problem-solving skill sets?
Yeah, I like that question. I think about that a lot, because I think there's a lot to be said for coming at something with fresh eyes. You know, when you're writing or you're reading and you just can't get past something, and then you show it to someone else and they say, oh, well, here's the mistake. And you say, well, how did I not see it? That's the human condition. But one of the things that I try to stress, one of the biggest takeaways for readers of the book and participants in my program, is I want to say to them, don't let perfection be the enemy of good. You know, sometimes good is just good enough. And that if we come with fresh eyes, that's terrific, but sometimes we don't have the benefit of fresh eyes, and we have to solve a problem with the eyes and experience that we have. And one example that comes to mind is, again, in Colorado this past October, you may remember that the wildlife game wardens found a wild elk running around with a tire around its neck. And it was so sad because they had it on film, and they kept seeing this wild elk, and they couldn't, because it was a wild elk, they couldn't taser it. And the elk evaded them, but the elk was gonna die. It had this heavy tire. And what was so sad was the elk had gotten the tire around its neck before it grew the antlers. And now it had full antlers and it couldn't dislodge the tire. So they had a problem to solve, and they didn't know how to solve it. Here, these game wardens are so experienced. So they were finally able to tase the elk. Now, I don't know much about tasing elks other than you have a short window of opportunity. And there was a steel band in the tire. They couldn't shave it off. What do? The elk is knocked out. We've got to get the tire off. So what did they do? They removed the antlers and they got the tire off its neck, and the elk woke up and it ran away. Everything was great. But the overarching problem of wildlife coming into contact with human pollution and detritus, did they solve that? No, but that's okay. Good was good enough here. Let's get that tire off the elk's neck so it's free of the pollution. And so sometimes I tell people, don't strive for perfection. Good is good enough. And if you don't have those fresh eyes or the opportunity for those fresh eyes, use the knowledge that you have. I was cheering those game wardens on. What did they do? Yeah, they had to shave the antlers off, but they got the tire off the elk's neck. And I use that now. I say sometimes, just get the tire off. Don't worry about the big problem.
Well, and there's so much to that. You know, one, if you were completely unfamiliar with that species or, you know, local knowledge, mm-hmm. you may be like, well, a tire normally belongs on an elk, and that's how they mark the elk here in Colorado. You could come to that conclusion, albeit, you know, strangely, or you might even say, well, you know, that's actually hurting the elk to cut its antlers off. And, you know, here are all the presumptions on why or why not. So I Absolutely. Guess managing, you know, I'm thinking of, you know, also in your book, you say managing contradictions, whether they're known or unknown contradictions. And you use that illustration of a donut. Do you sell a crushed donut, or do you just, you know, get rid of it? What do you
or
do?
Or give it to Amy to eat.
Yeah. Or give it to Pete to eat. So how do we manage those? And when we're dealt with, whether it's an elk or in the situation with the donut or in art?
you know, contradictions, we come in contact with them all the time, just every day. And I think that learning to manage your contradictions, again, with that standard of don't strive for perfection. Here's another example. Some parents have trackers on their kids' phones. They want to know where their kids are, or they want to monitor their texts to make sure that they're not engaging with dangerous people. You have to manage the contradiction of being able to be honest with your child and say, you know what, I'm watching your activity, but I respect your privacy. How do you reconcile the two? And to return to the elk analogy, I think the overarching concern came from the experienced game wardens when they said, you know what, maybe we should just leave the elk alone. But they were concerned it was going to die for two reasons. Number one, they were concerned that the tire was digging into the elk's neck and it was going to cause a big laceration, or that another elk was going to see that as a threat and see it as a predator and kill the elk. So they made the decision to intervene. And again, it's this weighted decision of managing these contradictions. Do we intervene with wildlife? But here we intervened. It was human detritus that caused the problem in the first place. But let's just do what we can to save the elk. And if we're going to keep our kids out of danger, yeah, maybe we have to forfeit some of that privacy. But the idea of saying, okay, I have a contradiction on my hand. Here's the benefits. Here are the detriments. Let me break it into digestible pieces and weigh it that way. It just gives you another way to look at something figuratively and literally. And that's why art just fits the bill, because everybody sees something.
We're speaking with Amy Herman about the fine art of problem solving. Her new book is called Fixed. Amy, you, in your business, The Art of Perception, you conduct professional development courses all over the globe for, you know, as we've already talked about, to a certain degree, FBI, the Department of Defense, Doctors Without Borders, NATO. And I'm just wondering how long it takes when you're in this sort of, you know, conference or workshop or whatever it is that you're introducing this. You know, what are those aha moments for people when you're talking about creative problem solving through honing your perception and largely about art?
I like to, as I say, throw my participants into the cold end of the pool immediately. I want to just get them in right away. So before we even start, I tell them who I am or what we're going to do. I say to them, introduce yourself to the person next to you. One of you close your eyes, one of you keep them open. And for the next 45 seconds, one of you is going to describe the work of art that I put up on the screen. And people are sort of, it's disarming. They're like, who is this lady? What do you mean, describe it? And I put up a slide. And you see people, they're like, oh, 45 seconds. And they describe and they talk. And you see the person with their eyes closed nodding because they're trying to visualize. And then I say, open your eyes. And there's this realization that what was described to them doesn't match what they envisioned. And they say, oh, maybe I didn't do such a good job. And then I have them switch places and the describer becomes the listener. And I show them what they saw, but I also show them what they missed. And I see the light bulb go on over their heads and they're thinking, oh my gosh, if I miss this, what am I missing back in the office? Or what am I missing at the crime scene? And I bring them in with their own participation. It's not about what I have to say. It's about what they're seeing and their self-realization. And people come out of my classes and think, wow, maybe I'm really good at that. Or some say, I really suck at this and I need to work on it. So it's the aha moments happen during the presentation when I show them what they see and what they're good at, but also showing them what they're not seeing. And that's very powerful because I spend a lot of time talking about what I call the pertinent negative. What are we missing that's hiding in plain sight? What are we not talking about? And frequently what's not there is more important than what is there.
I like that. The pertinent negative. That's a good thing.
It's pretty powerful.
I have to ask you this because we are speaking to you via Zoom and I can see you there. And back behind you, I just have to ask you about this, is this bookshelf. And everything is organized by color. So you've got the white books on the top, there's red in the middle, and then it goes down to green. And I have been wondering during this whole interview, why? Why is it organized like that?
I have a great answer, and you're probably thinking, she's nuts. Why is her bookshelf this way? And can I just say how great visualization is? Because before pandemic, nobody knew what my bookshelves look like. But oh, there you are. You can look at them now. I have them this way because a very, very dear friend of mine is a devotee of feng shui. and things should be in a certain order. And in my last apartment, I moved during pandemic. She said, I'm going to arrange your books by color. And I said, don't waste your time. I said, that's ridiculous. I don't need my books organized by color. I like my books the way they are. And she came in and she spent an afternoon and she organized them. And I have to be completely honest, it became a calm anchor in the middle of my crazy world. I would come in and see, and it also stretches to that side too. All my books are color coordinated. And I thought, this is so calming. And there's very little in my life that's orderly. So when I moved to the new apartment, I did this all by myself. It was so calming. I know now I associate my books with what color they are. And it is the topic of conversation when I'm on Zoom. Everyone says, did you do this for Zoom? Excuse me. And I love having my books arranged this way. It gives me a new way to visualize where they are and where they fit in. And it's a big topic of conversation in my interviews.
But then all the linear linguistic people are freaking out because that solution has created another problem for them. And they're like, I can't organize them or find the books based on the author or the title. Do you have that problem now on the new solution?
Well, to show you how elastic our brains really are, I know my books very well. I've lived with them for many, many years, and I do love my books, even though I told you I've started listening to books. And as I put the books together, my brain expanded its elasticity, and I now remember what books are what color. And even if I don't remember specifically that a book by Emile Zola has a gold cover, I know the spine is white because I remember putting it on the shelf. And my brain has expanded when you think you have no bandwidth left. I now think of my books. I know most of my art books are black and they're on the bottom shelf. But I think about books now, which books have a red cover. And if I can't find it, it's just sort of pleasurable to have your eyes span these colors to find the book you're looking for. And it's amazing. Our brains can do incredible things that we don't even think about. If you had told me 10 years ago, yeah, you're going to think about your books in terms of color, I'd say, yeah, I have enough to think about. But it is this sort of anchor of order in my life where I don't have a lot of other order. Mm. And so I love having my books this way. I would never have it any other way. But don't look at my bathroom cabinet. That's a whole other story.
I can absolutely understand that. It's like feeling some modicum of control over something in your life. If you're, you know, either your books or in my case, it's kind of like when I keep my car really clean, then I feel like I have control over my life, which also enables you to, you know, more creatively solve problems.
Or organize your skis by color. That would be
there
another
person.
You know, that's what Pete does.
To give you the opposite of example of this, I love to cook and I love to bake. My spices are, it's just bedlam in my spice cabinet. And it kind of annoys me that I can't find the Aleppo pepper and I know it's there, or the ground cumin or the cumin seeds. And it annoys me that I can't find them. I haven't changed it. So there are some things, as you said, when you have that modicum of control, it gives you a sense of calmness. But I'm fully aware that I can't have it in all aspects of my lives and of my life. And I don't profess that to anybody else. Ordering one thing is good.
Well, this is a brand new concept for me, I think for Pete as well, and hopefully our listeners. The book is Fixed, How to Perfect the Fine Art of Problem Solving. Our guest is Amy Herman. She is an art historian and attorney. What an interesting duality you have, and it's been an interesting conversation. Amy, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
All right. Take care.
And you too. Stay well.
Thank you. And stay with us. We will be back in just a moment. We'll be speaking with local author Elle Viajade, and she's going to tell us about the 90-day life. Mm. Yes, when we return. It's The Mountain Life, KPCW, Park City.
And welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Pete Stoughton.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Our next guest is Elle Viajade, a local Park City resident and author. In 2014, Elle walked away from her private practice and the 9-to-5 path so she could pursue her deeper dreams of exploring the world and becoming a mountaineer. She did this by narrowing her goals down into one 90-day period of her life. She realized in doing so that we are taught to put our lives on hold. She joins us now to discuss her new book, the 90-day life, how to live more in 3 months than you have in 3 years. She will share why, how, and the who of establishing your 90-day life. Elle Vijari, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me, beautiful people. I'm excited to be on today.
Yeah, it's great to have you on air. And I just really want to ask first, tell us a little bit about your previous life, per se, and what were some of those circumstances that really pivoted you from, you know, just enjoying that 9-to-5 clinical experience to where you're at now?
Yeah, so for the backstory, I found myself having lived most of my life on this very type A overachieving path. It was all I knew for my entire life ever since I was a kid. And I found myself in living in Washington, D.C., surrounded by suits, surrounded by status, surrounded by the chase of success, kind of getting drunk on the environment of it all. It was something I had worked so hard to pursue after being in school for years to build a practice in alternative medicine. It was a career that I loved, might I add. But I found myself surrounded by concrete and stress and pressure and working long stretches of time. And while I found these moments of joy working with my patients, I found that they were only momentary. And I found that once I stepped away from my work and I found myself in my own company evaluating where my life was at actually a really young age, I realized that I didn't want any of it. And it was a really weird realization because I realized that everything that I had been taught, everything that I had been modeled from the people in my life to society to convention was to push, to strive, to succeed, to hit these milestones and to keep pursuing and persevering. So I was looking around at my life and I realized I had it all on paper. You know, I could describe my life to someone and say, oh, you're doing so great. You have a successful practice. You can be your own boss. You're making an impact and taking care of people. But what I didn't like is who I was on the inside. I actually realized that so many things that I had been taught and so many parts of who I'd become weren't actually me. And I realized that if I didn't love the success, if I didn't love the life I had built, if I didn't love what I had been pursuing and the supposed goals that I had been achieving, then who am I without all of that? And for any high achiever, that's terrifying because you realize that you feel like you're in this almost crisis of identity more than anything. But the real pivot point for me happened more in a period of my life where I would find myself depressed every single night coming back from work. I found myself in toxic relationships. I found myself losing friendships while gaining weight. And I realized that who I was on the inside was crumbling, even though everything on the outside needed to change. So I realized that if I'm going to make a change, it's not going to happen from some self-help hack or some platitude. It's going to have to be drastic. It's going to have to be big. And I'm going to have to do it now because this is not sustainable.
So the question I have to ask, and this is courtesy of Lynn and her knowledge of Italian, your last name, Vijari, which I'm probably butchering because I am horrible at rolling R's, means to travel in Italian or journey. Was this something that you were destined to become because it was your original last name? Or did you embrace this as your new persona and take on this last name?
I am so excited that you asked this question because this is literally the first time I'm actually going to share this. This is actually a name I created. This is my name. This is not a name that was given to me. It wasn't a name I was birthed into. I actually realized that my name, my original name, my birth name, had a lot of its own baggage, a lot of its own generational ties, the things that I was taught associated with being this person. And I thought, what do I want my life to be? What do I want to embrace about myself? And I knew it meant being nomadic. I knew it meant being this explorer. I knew it meant being able to travel and to see things. And I literally started to research what words mean travel, what words mean journey in different languages. And then what words mean beautiful? What words would remind me to actually embrace that I'm this beautiful soul, this beautiful creature, this beautiful person? How can I remind myself every day that I'm not the insecurities that I've carried? I'm not the negative beliefs that I'm carried. I'm not the emotional baggage. What if I actually built a life that was a beautiful journey and my name was that? So my name, Elle Vijari, is a name that I created. It is my name and my own. So I love that Lynn has this knowledge of Italian, because I knew the question was going to come up. So I'm so excited to share. This is literally part of me stepping into an identity that I can call as mine with no associations whatsoever. So you could say I was destined, but it was actually more, I'm just choosing my destiny now. I'm not choosing what people have taught me. I'm not choosing the baggage that I've carried to try to maneuver through it. It's me choosing in my path and making sure that my name reminds me of that every single day.
What a great story. I have often thought about a new last name, mostly because I want more syllables. But I love Italian and I love to travel.
Also a great reason.
Now, if I also change my name to Viaggiare, could we be sisters?
I would love that. That would be fantastic. I was actually going to invite you. We could be a part of the Viaggiare tribe. I mean, Italian is so, so gorgeous. And it's funny, part of the identity that I'm stepping into is being this mountaineer, being fluent in multiple languages, having all these adventures in remote corners of the world. So it's really propelling me to step more and more into that. So yes, we can absolutely be Viaggiare sisters. And I clearly need to learn more Italian.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So, you know, some might say, as they're listening to you talk, well, it sounds like Elle had a pretty privileged life to be able to say, hey, I'm walking away from all of this and I'm creating a new thing. Tell us why that isn't necessarily true, or if it is, you know, how someone could go about doing what you've done with, you know, just making it from paycheck to paycheck.
It could not be further from the truth. I grew up on a dairy farm in the heart of Wisconsin. Most of my upbringing, my parents had empty cupboards and trying to figure out how they were going to put food on the table. Most of the time they hid the struggles that they had, and most of the time they embodied, you work for it. You work and you persevere and it's going to figure itself out. So there is no privilege in this journey. And I actually talk about this in my book. There's no pedestal. Throughout my entire life, I have had multiple bouts of struggling, multiple bouts of figuring out how I'm going to pay the bills, wondering if I could pay the mortgage. When I started my private practice, I had gone from making $30,000 a year, which, to be honest, after spending $150,000 in school, that's all on loans, I wonder what I got myself into. And then I found myself in a lot of situations where I wasn't sure if I would be able to pay the rent. I started off living in an apartment where I just had a mattress on the floor and would cry myself to sleep most nights thinking, what have I actually done with my life? Because this isn't what I signed up for. So that's a really important question that you've asked, because on the surface, it can seem like, oh, she's just made these choices and she's so lucky. Like, it must be nice to have whatever support that she has. It couldn't be further from the truth. A lot of this I've really done alone, or people in my life don't understand me wanting to change things or change ambitions and pivot away from things. So for people who are listening, I personally always find that the journey is much, much deeper. If whether you're living paycheck to paycheck or you have a mansion on Old Ranch Road, the bigger part of my journey and the bigger part of how I help people is that everybody is carrying baggage with them. Everybody is carrying some sense of pain or suffering. And a lot of that pain and suffering oftentimes comes down to not what's happening in their home or in their bank account, but it's what's happening in their head and heart. People who are choosing things to make them suffer, choosing beliefs to make them feel like they're suffering, choosing to not pursue something that makes their soul sing because they're afraid or feel guilt or feel shame. People who choose to punish themselves over their past or to be afraid about their future and find themselves stuck in the same version that they wish they could break out of but don't know how. That's really what this is about. And everyone's journey is very, very unique. So for me, I am very cognizant that I live in a self-help, personal growth world that's been mired by a lot of platitudes and you-rah-rahs and inspiring stories. I actually really like ripping off the scab and saying, what's really going on inside? What's the stuff we really need to figure out? What's the baggage that you're really carrying that we need to let go of? Because I've seen people from all walks of life and all socioeconomic status suffer, but it's more about what's going on between the ears than anything else.
Mm. Do you think that to a certain degree, you know, we have to have kind of the yin and the yang, or the, you know, the one side and then the other, where if you are a type A, you know, person that is achievement oriented, goal oriented, go, 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 then find out that you're actually suffering and then be able to walk away from that to come to this other side. You know, what if you never are that? You know, what if you haven't done the 9 to 5? What if you haven't, you know, made these certain goals on the one side to be able to balance it out with walking away?
Yeah, I think I love juxtapositions, right? I think you do need to have the struggle to define the bliss, right? And I think you need to have that to balance things out. So, you know, it's a very Buddhist philosophy, right? Where we have suffering throughout life, and that is part of the journey. So whether you're type A or not, the question I always love to ask is the persona that you have, the beliefs that you carry, the way you define ambition or life or happiness. Ask yourself, is this really yours? Is this really your you that you carry for yourself? Or was it given to you and just become so much a part of you that you forgot who you were along the way?
You know, I'm actually thinking as you're sharing, you know, the typical analogy or allegory is like the rat race of New York City. And you know, there's maybe one person fighting that stream, but I'm looking up at the resort and I'm seeing people ski, and what you mentioned was, you know, sometimes we are not aware, you know, conscious enough of where our paradigm's coming from. A lot of people are completely satisfied going up the lifts and skiing down, and I'm visually as an uphill skier. You know, imagining being at the same time going uphill on a ski route and saying, hey, come uphill, try a different journey. Do you find yourself in that same position? And how does one, you know, a lot of people are totally fulfilled by just skiing downhill. You know, you're kind of taking an uphill journey. Is that something that you kind of yell, hey, you know, over here, here's another way to get up?
And we are back. It's The Mountain Life on KPCW Park City. We lost Elle for just a moment, but she's back. So I don't know exactly where we lost you, but Pete was talking about the other journey.
The allegory of skiing. And so just wanted to ask your thoughts on that allegory of, you know, most people are totally fine going downhill and they enjoy that experience. And you seem to be going the uphill route. Talk to us a little bit about, like, you know, that can be a lonely journey. That can be one where hey, try another way. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of my life has been that, really living on a different path. And look, like, the skiing's a great analogy. It's really easy to find your edge and carve the turn, and life actually should feel downstream. Life should actually feel like you are going in the right direction. My hope is that for everyone, it does feel like skiing. I choose to literally go up mountains because I do like the push, and I do like the, I don't want to say struggle, but I like to go into some depths to figure out what can I actually do. So with that analogy, I find that people on the surface may feel like they're kind of coasting and cruising through life, right? They're living the day-to-day life. There's a routine, there's a comfort and a monotony. But I don't necessarily equate that to skiing, because typically underneath the surface, there's some kind of rub. And I'm talking for the people I like to help, right? The people that I help find that life looks really good on paper and they're cruising along just fine. But the people who get a little bit more aware and start to observe their life a little bit more and start to question, do I want to stay on this path? Is this still working for me? Is this still fulfilling? Or is there this itch inside? Is there this restlessness that's happening? I mean, look, like, we all know about the midlife crisis and then the quarter life crisis and then the millennial life crisis, right? It's happening on every level. And I believe the reason why that's happening is that it's very easy for people to coast, but I think that's different than going downhill. Going downhill should feel like flow. Going downhill should feel like you are connected to what your gut's telling you, to what is the path that you want to pursue. If you are coasting and there are signs or things that you wish you want to do differently, or patterns that you're doing in your life where you're sabotaging your happiness, or areas in your life aren't actually at the level that you want them to, but maybe you're putting up a good front, those are the things that are worth looking at. A lot of people don't have to. A lot of people can choose to not. But the people who do and are willing to go through that journey, it will feel uphill for a bit, but then they'll find their slopes. Then they'll find their line, right? So I really equate it to, and my coaching, I actually build it around going on this virtual expedition where people are literally going up their own mountain. How can they get to this next level of life, this next level of who they are, and leave their baggage behind? But then on the other side of that, then they can start to go down, right? Because then they found their flow. So I love that analogy and visual. I just see it as more of a whole journey. I also see the difference between coasting versus finding your line.
Mm. And you also mentioned going with your gut, you know, understanding those gut feelings and intuitions and questioning that. You have in your book a bunch of self-assessments, related assessments where you can say, hey, where am I on the scale? And my question is where were you able to create those? Is this a curriculum that you pulled from something else? Is this researched at all? Or is this just kind of from your experience?
Boy, it's such a culmination of things. And I think that's kind of the beauty as you go through life, you have experiences that have this compound effect along the way. From an academic standpoint, my background is in motivational psychology and kinesiology, which turned into a career in alternative medicine for a time. So for me, my philosophy has always been get to the root cause. If someone comes up to me with pain, what's really causing that pain? So my entire way that I've been trained to think is flowcharts and series of questions and doing a review of systems to break things down. So a lot of that training and philosophy came into now where when I'm reviewing someone, it's looking more at, okay, mentally, where are they at? Emotionally, where are they at? Where are they at in their behaviors, in their habits, in their thought patterns, in their tape loops? And then along the way, I've done a lot of training as well in disciplines like neuro-linguistic programming, cognitive behavior therapy, positive psychology, life coaching. It's been a journey along the way. That underlying philosophy has always been, let's get to the cause. I like to just say, what's this really about? So mired and mixed in with all of that is also my own personal experiences as well. Like, what have I learned over the past 20 years that if I could help someone not have to spend 20 years figuring out the same stuff, and I can expedite it through really poignant questions and through an accelerated process, then all the better. So it's a genuine potpourri, I guess you could say, of a lot of knowledge that I've gathered along the way.
We're speaking with Elle Viajade. She is a local Park City resident and an author. Her new book is The 90-Day Life. Why 90 days, Elle?
90 days is something that is actually well-researched in literature. That was kind of the easy thing to help people identify what can they do in a 90-day time frame. We've seen it in business applications, goal applications, but really in the psychology of our brain. People do better setting goals in a 90-day time frame than, let's say, a 30-day time frame like January and New Year's, where headlines are going to start to come out that people fail. It's been a really common research thing. But the reason being is that it actually takes both speed, but also efficiency to rewire what's going on in our minds. And I realized when I did my own 90-day period, and when I teach people on how to do that, they need both efficiency, but also accountability to themselves. You can achieve a lot of goals in 90 days, but in order to do that, you have to be able to change the wiring within yourself in a certain time frame as well. And it can take anywhere from 22 to 90 days to do that. A lot of times people, when they're looking to change their life or pursue a goal or to break a habit, it takes time for our brains to unwire all of that, typically years, if not decades, of conditioning, of emotional patterns and thought patterns and tape loops. And you have to be able to deconstruct that a little bit at a time, a stage at a time. The reason why people oftentimes fail in pursuing a goal is because the excuses and stall tactics and procrastination get in the way. Well, that's not a strategic issue. That's an internal issue. That's an identity issue. So 90 days is needed to give yourself time to deconstruct the thought patterns and neurologically give yourself the time to rebuild the way you think and perceive yourself in the world, but then also build yourself back up and reconnect to who you are and know, okay, who is that person? How do I live into that? How does that version think? How does that version believe? Because when you can adopt that, then the pursuit of the goal, I wouldn't say it's easier, it's still a slog, but you're going to be a lot more successful because you're a lot more in alignment with who you are.
So you've divided your book into three parts, the why, the how, and the who of establishing your 90-day life. What is the who? Who are these people?
Well, the who part is really, I start the book off with the how, because a lot of times when people pick up some type of self-help book, they want to know, okay, how do I do this? How do I make a change? Tell me for real this time, how can I accomplish this goal? But the who part is really where the self-assessment happens. It's really where they need to look at who are they in their own life? And is that version of themselves getting in their own way? I find that 80% of the work I do with my clients comes down to the psychology more than the strategy, above all things. So the who section of the book and where those gut checks come in really is about them looking at what are those patterns that have been holding them back. And it shows up different for everyone. So it's really them looking at what are the negative things where they're getting in their own way and how can they stop that so they can get back in alignment with what is actually the ideal version of themselves.
Well, we are out of time, Elle. It's been great speaking with you. How can people find you here in Park City if they want to learn more?
Well, the easiest way to find me would be to first go to my book site, 90daylifebook.com, or they can go to my website, which is LV, so L my name, ELLEV.world, and they can send contact info there, and there's ways where they can contact with me on social there as well.
Excellent. Elle Viaggiare, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. It's been great.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure as well.
And thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Thanks to our underwriters, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Backcountry, Connect Summit County, San Francisco Design, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.